From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden condemns Russian aggression during a visit to Ukraine. U.S. President Barack Obama announces major changes to a U.S. immigration policy. And Chinese activist trials raise question about the country's judicial reform.
Amnesty International has documented more than 100 people in mainland China who have been detained simply for voicing support for the Hong Kong protests.
It's all ahead. I'm Frances Alonzo. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden condemned Friday what he called Russian aggression against Ukraine after meeting with President Petro Poroshenko in Kiev. Biden said he and Mr. Poroshenko discussed the threat of Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity posed by Russia's military intervention, adding that it's simply unacceptable in the 21st century for countries to attempt to redraw borders by force in Europe or anywhere for that matter. Russian actions in Ukraine, the U.S. vice president said, are a flagrant violation of the bedrock principles of our international system. Biden is meeting Ukraine's leaders in an effort to underscore Washington's support for Kiev, which is battling a pro-Russian insurgency. Moscow has repeatedly denied arming the separatists in eastern Ukraine and has described Russian troops seen fighting alongside them as volunteers. Ahead of the talks in Kiev, a senior White House official said Biden is using Friday meetings to tell President Poroshenko and Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk of U.S. support. Biden's visit comes amid disagreement in Washington over whether to supply arms to the Ukrainian army, which at times has appeared to be outgunned by the rebels. VOA's Miroslav Gungadze is traveling with Biden. She says Kiev hopes to convince the White House to overcome its reluctance to provide the lethal defense aid.
The Ukrainian leaders are hoping to get assurance that the United States would stand with Ukraine. They need a real help, and it includes defense weapons to defend their territory. They are hoping to get that from Biden. We don't know the decision yet. A White House official is telling us that it's on the table. They are discussing the issue.
Meanwhile, Russia says U.S. lethal aid would further destabilize the crisis. Top-ranking Russian security official warned on Thursday that the conflict will grow if the U.S. aid materializes. President Barack Obama has announced sweeping changes to U.S. immigration policy. It's a move that will affect the lives of millions of undocumented immigrants. But the president's plan is also heating up opposition in Congress. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti reports from the White House.
President Obama addressed the American public from the White House, saying the U.S. immigration system is broken.
It's been this way for decades. And for decades, we haven't done much about it.
The president said his executive order will allow immigrants to come out of the shadows. It temporarily protects undocumented immigrants from deportation and gives them work permits as long as they have been in the U.S. more than 5 years, can pass a background check, and have children born here.
It does not apply to anyone who might come to America illegally in the future. It does not grant citizenship or the right to stay here permanently or offer the same benefits that citizens receive.
The priorities for deportation will now be terrorists, gang members, violent criminals, and recent arrivals. His plan expands the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, known as DACA, by shielding people from deportation for 3 years, providing they arrived before 2010 and enrolled in school, regardless of their current age.
Are we a nation that educates the world's best and brightest in our universities only to send them home to create businesses in countries that compete against us? Or are we a nation that encourages them to stay and create jobs here?
With more than 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country, the president's orders will affect about 5 million.
President Obama.
Republicans are bitterly fighting the plan, saying the president should not act alone. Leaders Mitch McConnell in the Senate and John Boehner in the House.
The president had said before that he's not king and he's not an emperor, but he's sure acting like one.
But make no mistake, when the newly elected representatives of the people take their seats, they will act.
But congressional scholar Thomas Mann doesn't think there's much Republicans can do.
The only way they can undo these orders in a practical way is to win the next presidential election. if they win it, they their president can withdraw those executive orders, and if the party wants to go with that position, they can.
President Obama has had his frustrations with legislators. Professor James Thurber has written about Congress and the presidency.
He obviously is thinking, well, they haven't done anything, the Republicans. They probably won't do anything. I'm going to get criticized for this anyway, but I want to do the right thing. It'll be part of my legacy.
The American public isn't so sure that executive orders are the way to fix immigration. A recent poll shows 48% against it, 38 in favor, and 14 unsure. The soonest any of these programs will go into effect is early next year. As one senior administration official put it, you don't just flip a switch and start the next day. At the White House, Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
Outspoken Chinese journalist Gao Yu has gone on trial for allegedly spreading state secrets. And in Zhejiang Friday, Uyghur academic Ilham Toti had his appeal of a life sentence for separatism denied. Shannon Van Sand reports on the trials that the Amnesty International rights group says expose China's deep hypocrisy to the rule of law.
The 70-year-old journalist Gao Yu went on trial Friday in Beijing. China has accused her of leaking state secrets. Her hearing came on the same day that a Chinese court rejected the appeal of lawyer and academic Ilham Toti, who was convicted in September on charges of separatism. Both trials come after China's central government has said improving rule of law is a priority under its agenda for reform. The Xinjiang High Court hearing of Toti's appeal was held inside an Urumqi detention center, which is not part of normal judicial procedure in China. The hearing also was scheduled at such short notice that neither of Toti's lawyers was able to attend. When asked whether Friday's hearing in Xinjiang reflected improvement in China's rule of law and judiciary system, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Hong Lei said the handling of this case is a part of China's progress in rule of law. He said judicial authorities dealt with this case according to rule of law, and judicial sovereignty is without any doubt. Governing the country according to law was the official theme of this year's Communist Party plenum, during which China granted local courts greater autonomy from the party. Chinese officials also now have to swear loyalty to China's constitution. William Ni is a China researcher with Amnesty International.
I think there are ways in which the government is showing that it wants to improve its criminal justice system and make it more fair.
But the handling of Gao and Toti's cases have raised questions about the promised reforms of China's judicial system. Gao was detained in secret on April 24th and formally arrested May 30th. CCTV, or Chinese state television, later broadcast a televised confession from Gao, which her brother said this week was made under duress. Toti's September trial was also closed door. Ni says Toti was denied food for 10 days and his legs were shackled. He also says several of Toti's students were held by authorities for several months and forced to give evidence against him. Toti's supporters protest his convictions on charges of separatism, saying that he was a mere advocate of Uyghur rights and reconciliation between the Han and Uyghur ethnic minority. Ni says that while China is making needed reforms to its judiciary, not all people are enjoying the benefits of those reforms.
You know, Amnesty International has documented more than 100 people in mainland China who have been detained simply for supporting, for voicing support for the Hong Kong protests. So this is a huge violation of freedom of expression. And so it's kind of a worrying sense that there's kind of this dual-track system where they want to promote the rule of law in most cases, but then when anything is deemed arbitrarily deemed politically sensitive, they can just kind of throw the rules out the window.
Toti's life sentence was the most severe handed down in a decade for illegal political speech. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
For women in Afghanistan, playing outdoor games was out of the question under the repressive Taliban government. But the emergence of a national women's football team in recent years is one of the many developments that symbolize changes the country has since undergone. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad, where the team recently competed in an international tournament.
The nascent Afghan women's team visited Pakistan this month, where it participated in the South Asian Football Federation Championship. Although the team won no matches, players sounded upbeat that they will do better in the future. They are also confident new president Ashraf Ghani will take further steps to promote women's football in Afghanistan. Frozan Tajalli, 21, is the captain of the Afghan women's team. She says that increased participation in international events is helping her players improve their skills. Tajalli says that for the first time in October, a four-team female league was organized in Kabul, and it also helped in identifying players for the national team. Yes, women are now free and can play football in Afghanistan. We organized the league recently for selecting the national team, and 20 girls came just from one province alone to Kabul to take part in the league, she said. Defender Yelda Arghandiwal came all the way from the United States to represent her country at the football championship held at Islamabad's Jinnah Stadium. The 20-year-old Afghan player acknowledged there are still cultural restrictions on women for playing football and other outdoor games in parts of Afghanistan. However, she says things have improved.
There's a lot more brighter cases in Afghanistan. It's not just the Taliban taking over and nobody has any rights. We do have rights. It's more free. We have our president. He's trying to make the country better for us. And yes, the women now are getting better. And as you see, this is a big example for you. They're out here playing soccer. So that should be a big improvement that, yes, Afghanistan is proving as a country and they will in the future.
Yelda comes from Kabul and moved to the United States a decade ago with her family, where she regularly started playing football. She says her team must improve to compete with countries like India and Nepal, who have been playing for several decades.
Yeah, we lost, but that doesn't matter. As long as we tried our best, we tried really, really hard, and we worked how we want to work, it's totally fine. This is just the beginning for Afghanistan national soccer team and for the women in Afghanistan. This could be a big start, and it could just lead us into a more brighter future.
Yelda was among five Afghan female players who are settled abroad, but represent their national team in international events at the request of Afghanistan Football Federation. Midfielder Shabnam Mubarez says Afghanistan has made significant progress in recent years in all areas, including football for women.
I see a bright future because we are starting to play football now.
Monika Stab, a German consultant from FIFA, watched the teams perform at the SAF Championship in Islamabad. Stapp says that she has noted a marked improvement in the Afghan team since she first saw them in action 7 years ago in Pakistan.
Afghanistan women want to play. I know the Taliban, all these people who say women should stay at home. Things are changing. We're now in 2014 and we have to give the girls the opportunity. We have to push them who want to play, let them play.
Members of the Afghan team wear black headscarves and full leggings in all of their matches to adhere to the country's conservative Islamic culture. Even after the Taliban's removal from power, gender segregation remains deeply rooted in Afghan life. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
For decades, subsidies on energy.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Plunging global crude oil prices are turning out to be a boon for India, a country which is heavily dependent on oil imports. From New Delhi, Anjana Pasricha reports how cheaper oil is boosting the government's efforts to lift the economy from a deep slump.
For decades, subsidies on energy in India have been a huge drag on government finances, but efforts to roll them back have been stalled by a public and political outcry. However, the nearly 25% slide in international crude prices since June provided a rare opportunity for the government to end its controls on diesel prices last month. Indian consumers barely noticed. The reason, despite the subsidy withdrawal, the plunging global oil prices means they're not paying more money at gas stations to fill their vehicles. Economists say Tumbling crude prices have brought multiple benefits. Oil is the single biggest import in a country which buys two-thirds of its needs from overseas. For one, they have eased the government's task of controlling its high fiscal deficit, says economist N.R. Bhanumurthy with the National Institute of Public Finance and Policy in New Delhi.
This is a pleasant surprise for India, to be specific, because this is one of the issues that has been, in the agenda of the finance ministry in terms of bringing down the oil subsidy so that to bring down overall headline fiscal deficit. So right now, we very clearly, one can say that this year, the fiscal deficit target of 4.1% can be easily achievable.
Cheaper crude has also played a key role in cooling inflation, which fell steeply from 10% last year to less than 6% last month. That is good news for a country where high inflation had led to a hike in interest rates, slowing investment and spending by consumers. But with more money in their pockets and lower energy prices, consumers are again upbeat, buying cars and other goods. 30-year-old Kavita Day, who bought a new car recently, opted for a bigger one which runs on gasoline instead of diesel. In India, for years, consumers preferred to buy vehicles which use diesel because the government subsidy made it cheaper than gasoline.
I was initially planning to buy a diesel car, but I didn't think it would make sense because, you know, the petrol-diesel difference has, you know, gone down drastically. And I honestly started off with a very small budget, but thinking that now even car prices have gone down comparatively, I decided to buy a slightly more expensive car so that I can indulge myself.
However, experts warn there is a downside to the decline in oil prices. Economist Bhanumurthy says that the slump in global commodity prices such as crude, coal and gold could signal a slowdown in major economies.
They are getting into the deflationary phase, something that needs to be looked at, because that would be the biggest risk for emerging market economies like India. Suddenly we see Japan is getting into recession, Germany is getting into recession. So what's happening to the external environment, which actually has a big impact on Indian economy.
But for the time being, the government has got more elbow room to put its finances in order, have more money to spend on critically needed infrastructure, and woo foreign investors to an economy that is already looking in better shape. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Researchers warn that the world's drylands are being severely affected by climate change. They say that could harm the livelihoods and food security for billions of people. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Scientists describe the projected effects of climate change on drylands as alarming. Dr. Jan Rupert is among those raising concerns.
Drylands cover a rather big amount of the terrestrial land surface, with 40%, a little bit more even. And they are home to approximately 2.5 billion people, of which more or less 1 billion directly live upon rangelands or upon very basic ecosystem services such as fodder to herd animals. They are very important for a huge amount of people.
Rupert is a rangeland ecologist at the University of Cologne. He conducted the research with his university colleague, Dr. Anja Lindstetter, who led the working group.
Drylands are not particularly deserts. Deserts are a part of drylands, but not all drylands are deserts. The main definition of drylands is that they have a scarcity of water, obviously. The transpiration of the water from the soil is higher than the water that comes into the system via precipitation. Actually, if you think of a savanna, that will also be a dryland in most cases.
He says drylands historically have fared pretty well during and after droughts, but they're more at risk now due to the effects of climate change. Human activity, such as raising livestock, can add environmental stress.
Due to climate change, the system is getting even more variable. So the droughts will be more regular and droughts might be even more severe. And this can trigger or can push the systems above a certain tipping point and could lead to degradation. That means a change in the vegetation that cannot be easily recovered from anymore.
He says very severe droughts that usually occur only once every 100 years may now occur much more often.
The systems not only suffer during a drought, but also need some time to recover after a drought to be fully functional again or to be on the same production level as they have been before the drought. And now if you can imagine that these droughts and even these very severe droughts, centennial scale droughts, come in more often, then we can expect gradual losses from the systems. The systems will not be as reliable as they have been before.
A centennial scale drought can greatly reduce the production of plant biomass by 45 to more than 70%. Biomass is material from living and recently living plants.
We should also consider how these numbers have been calculated and that they actually only represent single-year drought events. And usually a drought is a multi-year phenomenon, so these numbers are actually even more likely to underestimate the reduction in production because these effects from one year to another year, if you have a multi-year drought, might even add up and lead to even more pronounced losses.
Some dry lands could gradually turn to desert, a process called desertification. The rangeland ecologist says the type of plants on dry lands matters. For instance, dry lands with mostly annual plants, which complete their life cycle within one year, are more severely affected during droughts, but they recover more quickly afterwards. It's just the opposite when perennial plants, those that come back year after year, are in the majority. Dry lands are also more resistant to animal grazing during droughts when annual plants dominate. Rupert says eliminating grazing is not the answer to protecting dry lands during droughts and during their recovery. Instead, he says, there should be better grazing management, limiting the number of livestock on the land and using supplemental feed. Also, paying herders higher prices for a time would prevent them from increasing their livestock after a drought. The University of Cologne rangeland ecologist says protecting dry lands is a food security and a livelihood issue. However, he says, it does not get the attention it deserves at climate conferences. The next conference, COP20, opens in Lima, Peru, December 1st. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Demonstrators have clashed with police in Mexico's capital in a massive march protesting President Enrique Peña Nieto's handling of the apparent massacre of 43 college students. The skirmishes outside Mexico City's National Palace Thursday marred a mostly peaceful rally attended by thousands of people. Earlier Thursday, mass demonstrators sparred with police near Mexico City's airport, throwing Molotov cocktails and fireworks. The students vanished on September 16th in the city of Iguala. Officials believe the students were rounded up by local police and turned over to a local drug gang, Guerreros Unidos. The gang allegedly killed the students, burned their bodies, and threw the ashes into a river. The students' parents, however, have rejected the claims that their children are dead and have demanded the government find them alive. U.S. forecasters say a fierce winter storm in upstate New York is about done, but the flooding problems could be next as temperatures rise to nearly 16 degrees Celsius in the coming days. Many residents have been trapped in their homes, running out of medicine or without electric power in and around the city of Buffalo in western New York State. Weather watchers say an epic winter storm has dumped about 2.5 meters of snow, or at about an entire season's worth. Officials blame the Arctic blast for at least 8 deaths, mostly from exposure and heart attacks in several people who were outside shoveling snow. Some roofs creaked and caved in under the enormous weight of the snow. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis of global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.